Winter program session entitled Quantum Physics is a New Way of Seeing by Bill Giddings. First, I'd like to thank John Schramm for wanting this session to be a part of the winter program, as much of what I do back home involves trying to interpret ideas of this sort to people who are not associated professionally at all with science. I'd like also to thank Linnea Nelson for her enthusiasm for the Tao of Physics and her interest in The Turning Point, which led me to read these books, and my gratitude to Mary Schramm for having The Tao of Physics available in the bookstore and ordering The Turning Point for the library so that when Roxy cataloged it, I could check it out right away at just the proper time. And I wanted to get all of these acknowledgments on tape since none of these people is able to be with us today. One of my interests in having this be a part of the winter program, besides the relevance to the general theme of conversion as a new way of seeing, is to try to give some picture of what the nature of physical science is that may not, in fact, fit with everybody's ideas about that. Science is not a collection of facts in a book, but science is a process of gathering and interpreting information about nature through developing models that permit an understanding of relationships and the prediction of results of observations not yet performed. The process of science from a historical perspective was analyzed by Thomas Kuhn in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Normal science occupies most scientists all of their professional life as a community enterprise, something carried out by practitioners of particular scientific specialties that have remarkably similar educations and professional initiations, and thereby share the same background of information and the same goals of producing and validating scientific knowledge. Every once in a while, though, there comes a breakthrough that may be called a scientific revolution, as in the title, or paradigm shift, as in the text by Kuhn. The shared disciplinary matrix that these practitioners have is what Kuhn calls either a paradigm or a set of paradigms. One commentator on his book identified 22 different ways in which Kuhn used the word paradigm, so I won't try to define it precisely today, but we'll use it mainly as a part of the phrase paradigm shift, which is a handy label to denote those occasional scientific revolutions which so radically change the understanding of the world that you can't really read previous sources with an understanding of what they meant to people that had other paradigms, any more than we can really listen to Bach with 18th century ears. This sort of change has also been described as putting on a different kind of thinking cap, or viewing through a different set of spectacles, or today simply as a new way of seeing. In order to understand what is new about the new way of seeing of quantum mechanics in the first decades of this century, I will spend some time at the beginning describing the previous paradigm shift called the scientific revolution, capitalized, of the 16th and 17th centuries, so that we'll know where we may be shifting from. The dominant worldview in Europe up to 1500 rested on authority, actually on two authorities, Aristotle and the Church. These were combined into one conceptual framework by Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century. Aristotle had summarized and systematized all the knowledge of the natural world of his time, but he gave his priority to questions of the human soul and of divine perfection. The medieval Christian church, which dominated thinking for centuries, in Europe particularly, and surrounding areas, shared this relative lack of interest in the material world. The rediscovery of Greek science had stretched over 5 centuries, but it was overthrown in less than 2 centuries. Now, if we're going to avoid imposing our own paradigms upon those of the past, we should recognize that this scientific revolution actually consisted of at least 3 different traditions. All of them had their roots in Greek thought, and all of them were bound up with religious assumptions about the universe. The 3 may be called the organic, the magical, and the mechanistic. The organic tradition, like the medieval synthesis, was really based on Aristotle in emphasizing the role of observation and the need for intellectual coherence. In that organic tradition, analogies of growth and decay were used even when studying what we consider to be inanimate nature. Motions, for example, were described as being natural or unnatural. Key figures within the scientific revolution that were in this organic tradition included William Harvey, who discovered the circulation of the blood, and Francis Bacon, who is given credit for being the prime advocate of experimental approach as a basis of science. In what is called by Hugh Carney the magical tradition, the role of the scientist was to become attuned to the message of the universe. The Aristotelian tradition, including the organic tradition, viewed God as a rational first mover. In the magical tradition, God was a wonder worker, and the best way for scientists to follow was to become mystics. The secrets of the cosmos had been written by God in a mathematical language, as had been the view of Pythagoras and Plato in ancient Greece. For the Aristotelian tradition, the human soul was what provided form to the matter found in the human body. In the Neoplatonic tradition, the soul was imprisoned in the material world. According to that tradition, it is. Matter, however, was a link to the spiritual world, offering reflections of spiritual realities. This magical tradition included the work of Paracelsus, who revolutionized medicine by applying to it the systematic study of chemistry. But the magical tradition also included names such as those we associate with the beginning of the scientific revolution, Copernicus, and with its final flowering, Newton. Copernicus became an astronomer as a hermit-like gentleman of leisure. He studied in Italy and became acquainted with Neoplatonism, which emphasized secrecy, mathematics, mysticism, and the centrality of the sun as a revelation of God. Only other Neoplatonists accepted Copernicus's view of the planets as rotating and revolving about the sun after he died and his treatise became published. Not only Catholic, but Lutheran and Calvinist authorities rejected Copernicus, saying it was, at the same time, contradicted by the Bible. Luther said that since Joshua commanded the sun, not the earth, to stand still, then clearly it was the sun, not the earth, that must move. Also, it was this view of the sun as the center of the solar system was contradicted by common sense and by Aristotle and the tradition of his followers who still dominated the universities. Tycho Brahe was the most eminent astronomer of the late 16th century, rejected Copernicus completely, made precise astronomical observations so that he could become the foremost astrologer of his age and get rich. Johannes Kepler, however, belonged to the magical tradition and was among the few who accepted Copernicus's view from his youth. Kepler gained access to Tycho's data only by becoming his assistant. Before meeting Tycho, Kepler had written a book in which he claimed that the orbits of the 6 planets that were known at that time were related to the five regular solids of Euclid. His views were both mystical and geometrical. Well, the regular tetrahedron, the cube, and the other figures that have all of their faces made of polygons that have all of their lines and angles equal. Well, I've got a picture of it in here that I can show you. I can come across it soon enough.
A cube, for instance.
Yeah, a cube is one. A triangular pyramid is the first. And here they are. Pass that on around. Anyhow, it was a reflection of Kepler's view that God had created the universe according to mathematical laws. Kepler's later contribution, based on Tycho's data, that the planets' orbits must be elliptical rather than circular, wasn't appreciated until Newton, because of Kepler's Neoplatonic mysticism that portrayed God as the artist taking satisfaction in the music of the planets or the music of the spheres. The third tradition, which emerged as the dominant one in the 17th century and often is seen as the only one in the scientific revolution, is the mechanistic view of the universe. During the 16th century, there was a revival of the thought of Archimedes, with its emphasis on mechanical devices and analogies. Mathematics here was a tool for measurement and analysis, rather than the mystical clue to the nature of reality. God became the great engineer, and the scientist's task was to explore the interrelationship of the various parts of a machine-like universe. The modern application of mechanism began with Galileo, who accepted neither the worship of the sun and the belief in an earth soul of the Neoplatonists, or the magical tradition, nor the authority of the church and the Aristotelian emphasis on final causes on natural and unnatural motion that continued within the organic tradition. Galileo saw God as the divine craftsman, the architect of the cosmos, and the great mathematician. Galileo's Copernican astronomy was based on his observations through a telescope, which, contrary to rumor, he did not invent, including the first discovery of the moons of Jupiter. Galileo rejected Kepler's idea of elliptical orbits for the planets, along with Kepler's mysticism. But it was the Aristotelians that held on to the power in Italy at the time. By the end of the century, they were in disarray, but that was too late for Galileo. The philosophical basis for the mechanistic view was provided by René Descartes, who wrote with a combination of literary grace, human interest, and philosophical clarity that hadn't been seen since Plato's Dialogues. Descartes aimed to refute skepticism. See, Descartes saw God as the divine engineer, emphasizing the divine attributes of power and of truth. His picture of the natural world was based on particles in motion. The universe was a machine and nothing else. It was mathematical and logical and had no final causes except God. The mechanistic worldview or paradigm is often called Cartesian after Descartes. Mechanics, defined as the science of motion, is called Newtonian after Isaac Newton. Newton saw the planets and the smallest pebble as governed alike by the same laws. Newton also applied mechanical principles to the study of light. Yet he felt that this most beautiful system of sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being. Newton viewed the universe and all in it as a riddle, which could be solved by pure thought, by one attuned to mystic clues and cryptic revelations. His work was part of a religious and historical synthesis. He saw God as continuously involved in the universe, permeating absolute space and time. As a Pythagorean and Neoplatonist, Newton rediscovered the mystic Kepler's three laws of planetary motion and built his own mathematical law of gravity. The idea of gravitational attraction, action between two bodies at a distance, was rejected as much by the Cartesians as by the Aristotelians. But Newton's mathematical formulations of mechanics have served as the basis not only for all of physics till the 19th century, but for the secular mechanical paradigm that has dominated Western thought to the present day. Descartes and Newton became the new authorities, displacing Aristotle and Plato, as mechanism became dominant over the organic and magical traditions in the 18th century. John Locke developed a philosophy which regarded mathematics as the only approach to certainty. He thought morality to be the main aim of human existence, with ethics a realm of mathematical demonstration. Locke viewed Bacon as a better guide for reasoning than treatises on Greek logic. Locke was criticized for undermining traditional morality in Christian teaching. The scientific revolution became an intellectual revolution involving concepts of God and humanity as well as of nature. The nature of divine providence in a mechanistic universe was the subject of a debate in 1715 between Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz and Newton's ideas as defended by his follower Samuel Clarke. Leibniz argued that a perfect God must be a perfect watchmaker who foresaw everything and did not need to remain active in the universe, while Clarke argued for Newton that the watch universe needed continual divine government and supervision. Thomas Hobbes extended mechanism into the interpretation of human nature, building a system of ethics and politics upon the concept of movement as the essential feature of human life. Unlike the Aristotelian view of humans desiring what is good, Hobbes thought humanity defined as good whatever they desired. Hobbes had no place for mystery, miracles, or revelation from a God who for him was completely hidden. Before the scientific revolution, tradition was the source of values and modes of thought. The Reformation looked for a return to a true Christian tradition rather than something brand new. The scientific revolution had the effect of scrapping the past and building anew, despite the adherence of most scientists to the Bible and to Christian teaching. Benedict Spinoza was brought up as an Orthodox Jew, but turned to radical dissent in applying the Cartesian method of systematic doubt to the first five books of the Old Testament. William Petty, in the 17th century, mathematicized economics under the title Political Arithmetic. Adam Smith, a century later, depicted the economy as operating according to laws equivalent to Newton's laws for physics. The scientific revolution had effects which were practical as well as theoretical. Medicine, agriculture, and industry were changed drastically by the Baconian technique of careful observation and recording of data, especially in England, where the Royal Society, since 1661, had been interested in experimental approaches to improving the technical standards of industries, as well as improving the understanding of the workings of nature. On the European continent, the Cartesian tradition was stronger than the Baconian tradition, and mathematics, rather than applied arts and sciences, flourished there. The mechanism of Descartes results in breaking up thoughts into their simplest elements and arranging them into logical order. His radical doubt led him to the one thing he could not doubt, his own thinking. Cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Mind, for Descartes, was more certain than matter, and therefore separate and fundamentally distinct from it. He saw both mind and matter as creations of God, but his followers did not necessarily include God in their systems. The natural sciences concentrated their efforts on the material universe and the humanities upon the world of the thinking mind. Fritjof Capra, trained in theoretical physics, in The Turning Point, traces the influence of this mind-body dualism on all of Western thought. We see ourselves as isolated egos inhabiting bodies. We see other living organisms and the earth itself as machines without purpose to be manipulated and exploited for our benefit. Biologists, physicians, and psychologists for 300 years have taken the reductionistic or Cartesian approach of investigating portions and aspects of bodies and minds as the workings of machines. Newton's synthesis of the rational deductive method of Descartes with the experimental inductive approach of Bacon developed the methodology on which natural science has been based ever since, regardless of Newton's own interest in unorthodox theological theories and occult mysteries, for which he has been called the last of the magicians. All physical phenomena in the Newtonian universe took place in absolute three-dimensional space, always immovable and unchangeable. All changes were described within absolute time, flowing uniformly of and by itself, without external influence. Material particles moved within time and space under the force of gravity that acted instantaneously over a distance. Particles and forces to Newton were created by God and not subject to further analysis. The motions and attractions could only be described properly by mathematical equations, and to do so, Newton had to invent the differential calculus. God having created in the beginning the material particles and the forces between them and the fundamental laws of motion, then any complete description of the state of the universe at any time would enable calculation of the complete state of the universe at any other time in the future or past. Newton wasn't disturbed by discrepancies between his calculations of planetary motion and those actually observed, since he considered that God was always present to make corrections. Later mechanists like Laplace refined the calculations of the solar system to be perfectly stable and in agreement with observation without the need of God as a hypothesis. The success of Newtonian mechanics and astronomy led to its extension to other areas of physics, the motion of fluids, the vibration of elastic bodies, and the view of heat and the pressure of gases as resulting from the motion of invisible particles within them. Foundations of chemistry were laid by John Dalton in the early 19th century, describing the properties of atoms and molecules of elements and compounds. Locke's atomistic view of society as built of human beings that were born with blank minds that became imprinted by the experience of the senses became the basis for behavioristic schools of psychology and psychoanalysis, as well as for political philosophy of natural law that's been reflected in the Declaration of Independence and in the United States Constitution. Capra views the Cartesian view of organisms as machines, which are best understood by taking them apart and studying the interactions among their parts, as still being the basis of most contemporary biological thinking. He finds the limits of that approach to be related to difficulties in understanding the integrative functions of the nervous system, the development of embryos, and the interaction of cells and organisms with their environment. Western medicine, following the reductionist approach, is focused upon individual organs and upon bacteria and viruses as causal agents of disease, and ultimately upon molecular structures and mechanisms for isolated life processes. Physicians view their role as the repair of breakdowns of the body machine. Lost is a view of health and the phenomenon of healing, restoring the integrity of the whole organism functioning within its environment. Drugs, hormones, and organ transplants treat symptoms of disease without in themselves curing it, alleviating the suffering of individuals without necessarily improving the overall level of health, while escalating the cost of medical treatment at a frightening pace. Increases in life expectancy through the decline of infectious diseases seem to have come about less through medical intervention than through improvements in nutrition and hygiene and in sanitation. The health effects of stress, mental and social pathologies, lifestyle and environmental pollution show up in chronic and degenerative diseases, which are not effectively dealt with under the Cartesian biomedical framework, according to Capra's analysis. Newtonian psychology, he says, also suffers from overemphasis on the Cartesian division between mind and body, Following Locke, David Hume constructed an atomistic psychology in which the self was reduced to a bundle of perceptions, following Newton's inductive reasoning based on observation. Behavioristic psychology of John Watson eliminated the concept of consciousness, viewing living organisms as complex machines responding to external stimuli in a rigorous causal relation. Sigmund Freud applied a strictly rational and mechanistic approach to psychotherapy. Economic theory, founded on the mechanistic ideas of Locke, Petty, and Smith, was further developed by David Ricardo into a logical system of postulates and laws comprising an economic model. Karl Marx, in his role as social critic, pointed out the neglect of the ethical issues of distribution within economic models, yet Marx himself expressed his economic ideas in, quote, scientific, unquote, mathematical formulas within the Cartesian and Newtonian tradition. In the 20th century, John Maynard Keynes derived governmental interventionist policies from neoclassical or Newtonian economic models. CAP reviews the current economic problems of combined inflation and unemployment as the consequence of reliance upon outdated Cartesian economic models. These approaches that use reductionistic analysis of limited and abstract quantities ignore international dimensions, the concentration of power in multinational corporations, ecological impacts, and our dependence upon declining energy and natural resource bases. The consequence, yes?
Have they tried incorporating that into the Cartesian models, or is it possible?
Well, the impression I get is that the kinds of models they're using do not lend themselves at all. The basic approach they're using does not lend itself to this kind of systems interaction. The consequences of excessive emphasis on undifferentiated economic growth at the expense of other values have included disruption of the ecological basis of our existence, as well as creating a human environment which increasingly is physically and mentally unhealthy. Excessive production and consumption create massive quantities of toxic wastes and require huge amounts of non-renewable energy resources. Capra views the nuclear arms race as a threat of human extinction resulting from the same overemphasis on growth and competition, comprising the most tragic case of holding on to outmoded Cartesian paradigms. Additional unhealthy consequences of the obsession with economic growth include the industrialization of the food industry, leading to promotion through television advertising, primarily of food items injurious to health, as well as of alcohol, cigarettes, and the excessive use of both prescription and non-prescription drugs. Finally, in Capra's view, the industrialization of agriculture severely impacts the fertility of the soil in order to produce industrial commodities rather than healthful food. Fertilizer and pesticides, he says, add toxic residues to food while increasing the corporate control of global agricultural production, exacerbating the distribution problems that perpetuate hunger despite the possibility of producing an adequate food supply. So all the world's ills that we talk about in all of our other connections are thus attributed to misapplication of the Cartesian worldview from the scientific revolution 1500 to 1700, according to this point of view. Whether or not these applications of mechanistic paradigms borrowed from physics are judged to be overdone, either in the practice or in the analysis, there can be no question that not only the Cartesian insistence on the separation of the observer from the physical phenomenon, but also the Newtonian postulates of causality, of absolute space and time, have had to be abandoned in certain areas of investigation within physics. The inadequacy of Newtonian mechanics was first evident in the late 19th century in the investigations of electric and magnetic phenomena by Faraday and Maxwell. An electromagnetic field independent of material bodies could not be interpreted successfully by a Newtonian mechanical model, but a second model was needed for that particular group of phenomena. Since then, absolute space and time have had to be abandoned, at least when you're dealing with speeds approaching the speed of light or distances of interstellar space. The theories of special relativity, 1905, and of general relativity, 1915, connect mathematically space, time, matter, energy, electromagnetic, and gravitational phenomena through the work of Albert Einstein. These theories and their applications we will not try to describe under the heading of quantum mechanics. That's a whole different subject that I'm not prepared to talk about. Remainder of our time, we'll consider the realm of the very small, in which the Newtonian impenetrable atom became reduced to more fundamental particles, and in the process destroyed both determinism and the objectivity of observation, the separation of the observer from the observed, as tenable concepts fundamental to scientific understanding of the nature of matter, energy, and the universe. Although Newton had viewed light as made up of particles, in the 19th century Maxwell developed equations through which he interpreted light as an electromagnetic disturbance, uniting the sciences of optics and of electromagnetism. Waves of light in a vacuum, then, are propagated always at a constant velocity, without any need now for any medium within that vacuum to propagate them. Matter, since Dalton, became viewed as made up of smallest units or atoms which could not be further subdivided. Electricity seemed best described as a fluid, or rather two fluids, positive and negative electricity. Electric currents could be passed not only through wires made of metal, but also through tubes containing gases at very low pressure, some 0.2% of the pressure of the air surrounding us. Careful experiments of J.J. Thompson showed in 1897 that such cathode rays were made up of negative particles that were much smaller than any atom, and these became known as electrons. So the fluid was really made of particles of electricity. Thompson concluded that all matter contained such subatomic particles as identical components of all the elements. Whatever Thompson was made of, its atoms had electrons within them. The previous year, Becquerel had first reported radiation from uranium minerals which could penetrate black paper and expose a photographic plate inside. By 1900, Becquerel had shown that one of the several observed types of radioactivity was identical in properties to Thompson's electron. So, within 4 years, the indivisible atom had been shown to be made up of smaller pieces which were electrically charged. Some atoms gave off charged particles spontaneously, while many kinds of matter could be made to lose electrons when treated properly with electrical energy. Still, matter and electricity were considered to be made of pieces or particles, while energy was transmitted in the form of continuous waves, such as light or heat or sound. A common observation is that if you heat something hot enough, it will glow. First red, and then as it gets hotter, yellow, and eventually white hot. A difference in color is translated as a difference in the wavelength of light that enters our eye to be perceived. Careful studies of the amount of energy given off at different wavelengths by objects heated to different temperatures could not be fitted to the mathematical relationships of the known laws and theories near the turn of the 19th century. In the year 1900, Max Planck expressed the very latest accurate measurements others had just made of this energy wavelength spectrum of heat radiation in a simple formula that had revolutionary consequences. Planck could only interpret his formula by saying that atoms radiating heat could only contain certain specific quantities of energy. He called these particles or packets of energy quanta, from Latin for how much. This concept was so far from anything previously known in physics that Planck himself confided to his son that he had possibly made a discovery comparable only to those of Newton. And so indeed it proved to be, as the particle concept of energy became applied to atoms themselves and not just to the energy values that atoms could emit. Yet the particle nature of energy was not divorced from its wave behavior, As Planck's equation had the energy of the quantum proportional to its frequency, a property of waves. Einstein in 1905 showed that Planck's idea of quanta of energy traveling through space fit mathematically with the photoelectric effect, which is the release of electrons from certain metals when light hit them. The energy that the electrons carried off depended upon only the color or frequency of the light, not upon its brightness or intensity. Einstein also successfully applied quantum theory to the specific heats of solids, which relate the amount of temperature rise to the amount of heat added. Now, both light and heat were seen as having at the same time properties of waves, giving interference and diffraction patterns when you pass light through slits. Light waves can add and also cancel each other so that you get light and dark spaces. Streams of particles, it's hard to imagine if you're shooting, say, two machine guns, the bullets of one canceling out the bullets of the other. So, light and heat had wave properties, interference and diffraction, observed. But they also seem to be particle in nature in having only certain specific smallest amounts possible. Next, the nature of the atom was further clarified in the laboratory of Rutherford in 1911. Workers there bombarded a thin gold foil with a beam of alpha particles from a radioactive source. It was known already that alpha particles were as heavy as helium atoms and were positively charged. Nearly 99.9% of the alpha particles went more or less straight through the gold foil, as expected. But once in a while, one would bounce backwards toward its source.
This may be a really stupid question. What's an alpha particle?
Well, it's, for our purposes, it's just a form of radioactivity given off by uranium or something that falls apart naturally. They didn't really know what it was, so they called it alpha, beta, and gamma for A, B, and C. Yeah. Rutherford described this result as the most incredible event that has ever happened in my life. It was almost as if you fired a 16-inch shell at a piece of tissue paper and it came back and hit you. He calculated that this result required that nearly all of the mass and all of the positive charge of the atoms to be concentrated in a very small nucleus, the relative size of a grain of salt compared to the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral in Rome. The nucleus is to the atom as a grain of salt is to the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral in Rome. The rest of the space of what had been thought of as the solid, indestructible atom had to be occupied somehow by the electrons, which could only fill this space by moving through it very rapidly. Within 2 years, in 1913, Niels Bohr had developed a model for the motion of an electron in an atom. The electron was pictured as traveling around the nucleus in one of a set of possible circular orbits like planets around the sun. However, unlike planets or satellites, within the atom only certain specific orbits are possible. That is, only certain energies of the electron in the atom are possible, or the energies are said to be quantized. Any addition of energy, as when the atom is heated, had to correspond exactly to a jump between one allowed orbit and another. Nothing in between was possible. So also with any energy released had to correspond to dropping back to a smaller orbit. This interpretation fit the observation that a heated object that contains atoms of only one kind, of a single element, gives off only certain colors or frequencies, or energies of light. Bohr was able to calculate with simple algebraic equations just what the allowed energies should be for the orbits of the hydrogen atom, given the charge on the proton, the nucleus, and the charge on the electron, and the distance between them, and the kinetic energy of motion, all of which had been calculable for years. And he found that the results he got fit precisely with the observed lines or frequencies of light given off from the hydrogen spectrum when hydrogen atoms were heated. But there are only two problems with Bohr's theory. One, there was no explanation for this restriction to only certain quantized orbits that was without any counterpart in the world of things large enough to see. It just seemed to be that electrons behaved that way, but we didn't know why. And the other problem was was that it wasn't possible to calculate correctly the spectrum from any other element than hydrogen. Anytime you had more than one electron, this model didn't work. 1923. Question?
Oh, I just understood it.
Good. Louis de Broglie was pondering the need. Louis de Broglie in France. D-E-B-R-O-G-L-I-E. Was pondering the need for this dual picture of particle and wave when you're talking about light or heat. And with the arbitrary quantum restrictions placed on the energies of electrons in Bohr's orbits that otherwise fit the Newtonian mechanical picture, and had the flash of insight that this suggested that electrons were really behaving like waves. So both the electron, a particle of matter, and light, a form of energy, seemed to be showing properties, behavior, of both particles and waves.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I think I got the concept of particles, but waves still eludes me. You just talk about wavelength, and
well, we can.
It might be irrelevant, but it seems to be getting deeper.
Okay. All we can do for a wave is to draw a picture. Like on
light waves and sound waves. And
any kind of wave you're talking about, a model would be the same sort of thing. It goes up and down, and the wavelength is the distance from one crest to another. The frequency is how many waves go by you if you stand and count them each second.
How do we get that concept of up and down and light?
Well, the concept we get from observations on the lake. As far as light, what is waving is an electromagnetic field that has no need for any material object, and I can't explain that. This is late 19th century. Pardon?
Talk about a pond again.
Well, of course, in the pond, the water actually just goes up and down in the same place, and the wave is not the water itself moving, but a disturbance of the water moving.
Like a string that moves, goes up and down, and the faster it swings, the more times it swings per certain, the higher the note gets.
Yeah.
And if you do that even more, then you go from the sun to the
just in speed of emission has to do with the length.
Well, there are three things that are all related. One is the speed the wave is going. And that you find if you take the length of each wave, how far it is between them, and multiply it by the number of them that you get each second, then you get distance divided by seconds, which is speed.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, we have enough trouble trying to understand what we mean by a wave of light, and the idea of light being as waves fits with its behavior. If you have waves coming in to appear with a lot of pillars supporting it, then you get patterns broken up where the waves cancel and add to each other that are exactly like the patterns you get shining light through slits the proper distance apart. So the expression wave is an analogy to something that you can actually see. 3 years after de Broglie had the idea of treating electrons like waves, Erwin Schrödinger wrote out a mathematical expression that treated explicitly an electron in an atom as a wave, or wave mechanics. But in so doing, he had to abandon any idea of direct physical significance for what it was that was waving. The following year, the wave behavior of electrons was experimentally verified by passing electron beams through crystals. The experimenters got diffraction patterns, just like passing light through slits or waves through sets of pilings. So electrons do indeed behave like waves, according to the kinds of experiments that really define what we mean by waves. Though both theoretically and experimentally, electrons behave both as particles and waves. The answer you get depends on how you ask the question in the particular experiment involved. There had been a different mathematical formulation of quantum mechanics that didn't involve the mathematics of wave language, but something called matrix mechanics that Heisenberg had developed. And Schrödinger was able to show later on that his wave mechanics and Heisenberg's matrix mechanics were saying exactly the same thing in different language, which wasn't obvious until it was proved mathematically. But again, how either of these kinds of equations actually represented electrons and atoms was still unclear. Max Born interpreted the expressions as a probability function. Now, probability was a concept that often expresses a limitation of our degree of knowledge of a situation. How likely is something to happen, we ask, because we don't really know. But in this case, it has another meaning of a tendency for something to happen, which somehow stands between possibility and reality. We'll get back to some of the ideas of probability soon. So if you find these concepts are confusing and unpalatable, you're in good company. In the autumn of 1926, Bohr, Schrödinger, Heisenberg, and others met in Copenhagen for intensive discussion of all the questions of interpretation of quantum theory. Heisenberg recalled, "I remember discussions with Bohr which went through many hours till very late at night and ended almost in despair. And when at the end of the discussion I went alone for a walk in the neighboring park, I repeated to myself again and again the question, can nature possibly be as absurd as it seemed to us in these atomic experiments?" It was indeed a revolution in physics. Most, but not all, physicists became satisfied with the eventual clarification, at least clarified it to them. Bohr viewed the particle picture and the wave picture as being complementary, needed to complete each other. For each description, particle. Each description is only partially true, so there must be limitations to how you can apply each, or else they would contradict each other. Heisenberg expressed these limitations in his uncertainty principle. Now, by Newtonian mechanics, you can describe precisely both where something is and how fast it's moving in what direction. On the atomic scale, you can't do that. It becomes impossible to fix both the position and the velocity at the same time. The more accurately you fix either one in a given experimental situation, the less you know about the other. And that uncertainty isn't just because of limits of present experimental techniques and equipment. It's built in to the nature of things. If we decide to measure the position of a particle precisely, then it simply does not have a well-definable velocity. and that results from the inadequacy of a particle being a model for an electron. Electrons do not behave completely like particles, regardless of what experimental situation might be involved.
Well, it would be like trying to follow one drop of water.
Mm-hmm.
You can see the wave, you see the water, but you couldn't follow one drop.
Well, you could imagine that you could follow one drop. It just goes up and down. Plus, of course, the drops are, molecules are always moving about each other anyhow. The same uncertainty results if you try to define time and energy at the same time. For objects big enough to see, uncertainties of this sort are too small to measure. And it's only when you get down to the infinitesimally small atomic scale that this difference becomes important. Another way to understand the uncertainty principle is to realize that on the atomic scale, you can't, of course, observe something directly. There has to be some experimental process which produces a sensation like reading a meter or seeing a flash of light or something. And it's not possible to perform these experimental observations without affecting what you are observing, since light is made of particles and waves. If you're going to bounce a particle of light off an electron to see where it is, that's how we see, is by light bouncing off something and coming to our eye, then it's going to give the electron such a kick that wherever it was going before, it's going somewhere else afterwards. As Heisenberg said, natural science does not simply describe and explain nature. It is part of the interplay between nature and ourselves. What we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning. The decision of the observer about the experimental process determines to a significant extent the properties which will be observed. The universe will never afterward be the same. In some strange sense, the universe is a participatory universe. So, the mechanistic or deterministic universe supposed that an object in some defined state of motion at a defined place, if operated upon by a defined force, could have its behavior precisely predicted. In Born's words, when you're dealing with the atoms, one obtains the answer to the question not what is the state after the collision of two electrons or something, but how probable is a given effect of the collision. Here the whole problem of determinism arises. From the point of view of our quantum mechanics, there exists no quantity which in an individual case causally determines the effect of a collision. I myself tend to give up determinism in the atomic world. Although both Bohr and Heisenberg considered this interpretation was obvious, once it had been shown that the wave mechanics and the quantum mechanics were the same thing, Schrödinger never accepted this interpretation, nor did Planck, nor did Einstein. In an often quoted letter to Born in 1926, Einstein wrote, "The theory says a lot, but does not really bring us any closer to the secret of the old one. I, at any rate, am convinced that he is not playing at dice."
Oh, that's a famous one.
That's a very famous one, yes.
Yeah.
Right. Norbert Wiener, whom Born visited at MIT in 1925, wrote in 1956, "It has been well said that the modern physicist is a quantum theorist on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and a student of gravitational relativity on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. On Sunday, the physicist is neither, but is praying to his God that someone, preferably himself, will find the reconciliation between these two views, the quantum theory and relativity." And that reconciliation is still being sought. The very search for fundamental building blocks of matter since Democritus in ancient Greece must now be seen differently from the 1930s, when they thought they had the atom all figured out as made up of just three types of fundamental pieces, particles, protons and neutrons in the nucleus, surrounded by electrons that were somehow both particles and waves. But what held the nucleus together was problematic. We won't really try to go into that, other than to say that now over 200 so-called elementary particles have been described. Many of them are pairs of particles and antiparticles, which can be formed from and converted into photons, which are quanta of electromagnetic energy that have no mass. In order to form these particle processes, you have to put in enough energy so that the new particles you get by breaking up the old ones are bigger than the old ones were, because by relativity, matter and energy are interconvertible, and physicists do it every day. We converted about a gram of uranium-235 into energy in Hiroshima. The very idea that composite objects are made of basic building blocks has lost its usefulness, the Cartesian paradigm. Particles are now seen as dynamic patterns or processes rather than pieces of stuff, and understood only in terms of activity. The entire universe appears as a dynamic web of inseparable energy patterns. The particle cannot be seen as an isolated entity, but it has to be understood as an integrated part of the whole. Such descriptions of these events are in terms of complex mathematical formalisms, which are nearly impossible to visualize or express in words, even if you understand the mathematics. So, rather than considering that the universe is inherently mathematical in nature, like Pythagoras, Plato, Copernicus, and Newton, the implications of theoretical physics are that ultimately the structures and phenomena we observe in nature are creations of our mathematicizing mind and its interactions with the rest of the universe. Some present-day physicists argue that human consciousness may be a necessary part of future theories of matter. You can't break things down to their smallest parts. There are no smallest parts. There is only activity and interrelationship.
Well, there's a place where one merges with the other.
Mm-hmm. And it's all interconvertible. Well, since we're not all physicists, probably none of us is physicists, so what? Well, in The Turning Point, Capra develops at length his new vision of reality, which he bases on a unified organic worldview, which he finds, one, in quantum mechanics, and two, in classical Eastern philosophy and mysticism, so that in, as the Tao of physics is an explanation of these similarities, so that indeed Carinate Matins began today's session, in a sense. In The Turning Point, he develops a systems view of life, which, like physical science, consists of mutually consistent interlocking concepts and models. None is more fundamental than others. All must be consistent with each other. You can't derive any from the others. He concentrates particularly on concepts of individual and social health, for which the mechanistic view he finds particularly inadequate, though living organisms indeed have machine-like parts and mechanisms. To understand their interactions, the whole is always more than the sum of its parts. Like the complementarity of wave and particle, as both being partial descriptions, he sees reductionism, digging for the small parts, and holism, looking at the entire system, as complementary, that have to be used in proper balance to see that organic structure is determined by dynamic processes of self-organization, including self-renewal and self-transcendence, that you'll never find if you just pick it to pieces and look at the pieces. He also sees determinism and free will as relative complementary concepts rather than mutually exclusive opposites. Sees organization as occurring on multiple levels. Biologically, the atoms, the molecules, the cells, the tissues, the organs, the organisms, the ecosystems, and the entire biosphere are successively larger units of organization, which are not independent of each other. Living organisms are open systems requiring transactions with their environment to keep themselves alive and functioning. A holistic approach to health and healing he finds compatible both with many traditional views, particularly Eastern, and with modern scientific theories, quantum and relativity. Health implies harmony of the individual with the natural and social environment and with one's own nature and way of life, an ongoing dynamic process rather than a static state. He expands the concept of consciousness to include collective transpersonal levels that can't be investigated exclusively by quantitative measurement. Although, by quantum theory, the investigator's consciousness has a crucial role in the process of observation, quantum mechanics cannot study the nature of human consciousness itself by its quantitative models. Again, he says we need mutually consistent partial models rather than attempts to reduce all sciences to one chosen as the most fundamental. He also applies these ideas to economics, to a healthy economic system being one which is in a state of dynamic balance of continually fluctuating variables rather than trying to maximize gross national product or profit and ignore everything else. He sees that our value systems must shift from self-assertion and competition, which he sees as Cartesian, to cooperation and social justice, which he sees as holistic, from expansion to conservation, from material acquisition to inner growth, so that the existential scarcities, which are not material resources, but peace of mind, love, community, and self-realization, can actually be found. And he has a lot to say about decentralization, soft technology, and a lot of other things that we talk about in other connections he sees as implied by his understanding, professional understanding of quantum physics. He, in fact, views our culture as being in the process of transformation from a Cartesian to a systems point of view. He looks at citizens' movements that have formed around social and environmental issues tending to converge and cooperate with each other, counter-economies of cooperatives and the barter of skills and homemade goods is emerging beside the market economy, worker participation and management spreading, a deep ecology movement reviving an awareness of the oneness of all life, which he sees similarities both to the Taoist tradition from China and to the thought of Heraclitus from ancient Greece and of St. Francis, about whom we have also heard around here, extending all this to a planetary level. The holistic health movement has begun to penetrate the medical profession. Feminist spirituality he sees akin to the ecological vision. Ethnic and third world liberation movements challenging authority and power structures. Capra believes that networks and coalitions among all these groups eventually will form a majority able to turn the paradigm shift into a political reality, despite the refusal of the declining, patriarchal, corporate-centered Cartesian culture to recognize that the turning point is approaching. Well, there are... He does give... reference to Teilhard de Chardin, but I haven't read enough Chardin to be able to interpret what he says about it. Now, one can criticize many things about Capra's point of view as being overly simplistic, as in fact being reductionistic itself by saying that if you can't understand subatomic particles as separate entities, then neither can you understand all the universe is made up of separate entities. And it's considered that his faith that this transition that he so much desires will necessarily happen may be more wishful thinking than justified by the evidence. But it seems to me that it certainly must be instructive to examine our current institutions and problems, as Capra does, to determine what presuppositions and value judgments are inherent in them, and I find his analysis of that to be quite plausible. Those disciplines which pattern themselves after Descartes and Newton, giving quantitative mechanical models, do need to consider that that paradigm has definitely been found to be of limited applicability, even for describing the physical universe, and it can hardly then be accepted uncritically as the sole basis for investigating phenomena of life and the mind of the individual and of society. Those movements that Capra cites as coalescing into a new world vision have all arisen because of genuinely perceived inadequacies of our present structures and institutions to solve real problems. If his elaboration of a systems view is taken as pointing a direction rather than being the kind of analysis on a reductionistic level that he deplores, then the revolution in quantum physics may indeed be valuable in helping all of us to see ourselves and our universe more fully.
Bill, you mentioned earlier that Capra takes determinism and relativism and combines them or sees an interaction between them rather than seeing them as mutually exclusive. Could you explain that a little bit?
Well, again, I think it's a matter of the answer you get depends on how you ask the question. That our own consciousness interacting with whatever phenomena we use to try to decide, is this completely determined ahead of time, or are there elements of free will involved?
I've heard it described this way, that one has free will or freedom of choice before one takes an action, but once one decides and takes the action, there's an element of determinism involved.
The determinism and free will are also described as a continuum by Tolstoy in the second epilogue to War and Peace, where he viewed that the individual soldier on the battlefield actually had a great deal of free choice, whereas Napoleon and the Tsar had practically none because of all of the interactions that they were involved in. Anyhow, those people who viewed, and I would count B.F. Skinner as one of them, everything as being predetermined in advance, because mechanically, if you can describe the universe now, you can describe it later, have at least some of the ground cut from under them, whether they realize it or not. If they realize that you cannot describe the universe and what we look at as its fundamental components in those terms at all anymore. Therefore, we'd better be careful about describing other parts of it.